Hello, welcome. I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And I'm John Ingold.
Welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Every week, we flip to a page of the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book and we interview one of the contributors about their chosen topic. This week, we have Konstantinos Dimopoulos, and he will be describing to us a very fun topic that we are excited to get into. Our focus, as always, is about the craft of game writing and how we deal with all the little problems along the way. So, thank you, Konstantinos, for joining us. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind giving us a little bit of an intro of who you are, share with the audience your journey, what brought you into this world.
So thank you both for the invite and also for putting this book together. So what I mainly do, in games is I'm working as a game urbanist. So a game urbanist is something that I've more or less coined myself as a term, as a discipline. And effectively, it sort of combines my knowledge of, urbanism, because this is what I've had studied for years and where I specialized in, with game design, level design, writing, and, all the disciplines that can tie in with it. Effectively, it's about, analyzing and building cities, their systems, urban levels, this sort of thing, specifically in the medium of games, not necessarily just video games. So this is mainly what I do. And, it comes with some extras, like, I tend to teach game design and level design. I tend to, write stuff, do some narrative design, a variety of other things that are mainly, arranged around this central pillar of urbanism.
It's amazing. So for the book, your article was called On Entering Cities in Interesting and Memorable Ways. So obviously it's drawing a strand out of the work that you do. So for the benefit of people who might not have read the article, can you just sort of briefly outline what were you talking about? What's your
thesis? Very briefly, this is, as the title hopefully makes abundantly clear, this is an article about, the art of creating an interesting entrance, of something that will be able to introduce people into an urban world. And this article draws not just from, the experiences that we've enjoyed within game worlds, but also from real life examples. So in reality, people have been thinking about how to introduce other people and strangers in their city, and what emotions they would like to evoke, and what image they would like to present to other people. And I thought that taking those actual historical approaches to the question of how do we enter a place, and enriching them with the affordances of our medium, would be an interesting thing to discuss. So the whole idea is, how do we create those first few moments that will tell people what it is they should be expecting, and perhaps give them a good idea of the overall structure of the place they're in, so that they can sort of have this scaffolding on which to, support their imaginations. And I think that's about it. I mean, I've drawn from a variety of examples, both in-game and from history, and
I mean, this is really good. I would love for us to dive in the course of this talk about the purpose of this and how you sort of think about this, how you design these things in different contexts. But you do, just as you reference here, you do talk about in your article historical examples or sort of real life examples, as well as really solid examples in games that you think are interesting. Mm-hmm. Would you mind covering just a couple of these types of examples? It doesn't have to be what's in your article. Games that you think have done this really well, real life examples that are interesting, please.
Sure. Again, I mean, I have to once again, mention Half-Life 2 and City 17. The way that you're brought into this world, the way that you, you take a train as you would, in many cases in real life, at least, in Europe and many other places. I mean, you do take a train to go to a new place. So you are familiar with this journey from the actual train to the train station, and then outside to the city itself. And the way that Half-Life 2 sort of uses this familiar experience to introduce you to this completely different and oppressive world is really effective. And it also feels right. I mean, it feels very close to what you would do in real life. And then, other examples would include Midgar from Final Fantasy VII. And I'm always referring to the old game. I have never played through me, to be honest. I don't know, it feels too shiny for me. But still, apparently it's very good. But the idea is that, you know, the game very, very quickly, besides once again, you know, introducing you via train into the game world, it very quickly gives you a very strong idea of where you are. It explains its world building with, you know, a short cutscene that shows you this, you know, two-tiered city with this huge thing in the middle, and instantly you know where you are, and you can always remember where you are. I mean, even though that you tend to play in a more zoomed in, more neighborhood like level of the city, you still have this very, very simple, very legible structure in your mind, and you can actually place yourself within it. So you don't have to be constantly reminded that, look, you are in this large, vast place. The image was so well, you know, presented to you and was so, so legible that you cannot really forget it. So this is another fine example. I could go on and say like 15 others, but...
So, for writers out there who are sort of reading this and thinking about it, you know, and going to do something similar, what are the sort of, what are the axes along which we can be creative in this respect? You know, I mean, you've mentioned kind of architecture, but obviously there's lots of different, lots of different things we can bring into play. So what are the sort of things that you think about when kind of doing this sort of work yourself?
I imagine it always, you know, depends on what it is we want people to pay attention to. So depending on the type of world and city we're building, you know, and depending on the effect we aim for the entrance to have, we should probably do different things. So, I mean, perhaps we want to fool people into believing that they're entering this, you know, welcoming and cozy and warm world, and then, you know, shock them with something entirely different. Or we want to give them a very good and clear idea of where they are, as Midgar did. Or we want to create this strong sense of dread. I mean, and this is a real life example. I do remember ages ago when I was I landed in Singapore for a thing. And you have those like large billboards, or at least you used to have those large billboards telling you that, you know, if we find drugs on you, you will be persecuted, and the penalty for this is death. And I mean, even though I obviously didn't have drugs with me, you sort of feel uneasy. It's like, what if somehow?
what would happen accidentally?
Yes. And it's an actual introduction into a place that isn't, you know, the most liberal place in the world. It's a place where things get persecuted, where things are quite strict. So this is effective. I mean, this is a very effective way of telling you that, look, you are in a place where those specific rules apply, and you have to be very, very aware of that, even if this scares you. So you know, those things could easily be done in games. And then, you know, there's also the option to choose to build something up in someone's mind. I mean, again, you know, in The Witcher, the third Witcher game, you keep hearing about Novigrad like long before you see it. You have like conversations in taverns about it. You see it from afar. You have all those things that constantly build it up in your mind. You're really excited to get there. Thankfully, it doesn't disappoint, because I mean the same thing happened with what was the Alliance capital in World of Warcraft?
Well, I do not know.
Anyway,
I don't know.
Still, I mean, you had this. You kept being told that there's this huge place where, you know, everything happens and everyone comes together and things are super exciting and things are super rich and powerful. And you enter a place with like 5 shops and 15 NPCs and 5 players.
Yes,
and it's
yes,
like, okay,
yes.
This is not exactly what I had in mind. So,
actually, so it's funny you said this. It's funny you said this, because there were a couple things you mentioned in your article that I wanted to bring up. One is referring to your arrival in Singapore. You very modestly point out that nowadays an airport is a very common gateway to a city, usually designed more for speed and efficiency rather than memorability. And I was like, what a shame, right? What a shame that we no longer have these like grand entrances.
This is very true. We don't really care about that so much, do we? Unless we're a very tourist place.
Yeah.
Which doesn't
matter. Yeah, and maybe because there's a little bit less singular control over what's happening, so you have a bunch of different local authorities, and so you know, someone's trying to funnel tourists from one space to the other. But then once you get into the town, they can organize a pedestrianized street and do things like this. But when you talk about this, the other thing that it made me think, when you talk about places that disappoint, I suppose, I remember feeling a very something very I did not expect across the Mass Effect series. Now, you reference Mass Effect and the Citadel as something that's also built up in your mind ahead of time. And I remember in the first game, and you know, I was so into this when I played it. In the first game, I get to the Citadel, and I was like, oh, this is the Citadel. And it is indeed a little disappointing. It sort of feels like there's three or four places to go to. Yeah. But then I remember feeling that in the second and the third game, suddenly it became clear to me that no, they were implying a much bigger place, and you only saw one sort of shard of it, and you get to see much more as it goes on. And that seems also quite powerful, that to appreciate that a city can have districts or different ways you can enter it, and mm-hmm. that can change the way you encounter it. So, yeah, I don't know if that's something that you've been able to apply in your games at all.
I think that is a very, very interesting thing to look at, because, I mean, in reality, whenever you're suggesting something as vast as the Citadel, you know, you also have to keep in mind that you could never really, you know, render it or model it in any way. But you have to make absolutely certain that people are reminded of the context. So, I mean, again, you're very right. I mean, I wasn't disappointed in the Citadel because I first, you know, played Mass Effect 2 and Mass Effect 3 and then came back to,
to
Mass Effect 1 because I just, you know, had to know what happened there. And then I replayed the whole thing, whatever, doesn't really matter. The thing is that, you know, if you were helped and if you were, you know, told with little fake trips from place to place or with references or with views, if you were being reminded that this is a vast place and you only get to see those few, like, locales from this actually vast place, then this would be way, way more effective. And it's this, you know, effectively this art of implying space, of suggesting that there's much more to what you're seeing, of, you know, having a dog bark outside the confines of a level. It's something that you can hear that tells you that, look, the thing expands. You can't go there, but you're reminded of the scale. You know, okay, the first Mass Effect didn't do that as well. And admittedly, the second one didn't do that as well either, but that's fine. That's okay.
I love this idea, though, of implying a larger space, because I think games are often constrained by this. You know, the camera sits inside the player and they see what the player sees. So if you want to make a large space, you have to build the whole thing. And there's this very, we tend to lean on the direct experience of the player a lot. But if you look at something like television, of course, they're always doing, especially, you know, sci-fi TV shows are always doing this implication shot where they'll show a vista of the planet and then they'll cut to the single room inside the Capitol building, which all of the scenes are on. And they do it in Star Trek. They do it in Babylon 5. They do it in everything. But they constantly cut back to that planet. So just to keep reminding you, this is a whole world. This is a whole world. This is a whole world. But they can do it because the camera isn't in the player's face the whole time. Yeah, it works brilliantly. So I think that's really interesting. And I wonder what ways we have to do that. Obviously, the entering a city is a great moment because it's a bottleneck the player has to drive through. You can really control the experience there in a very natural way. Exactly. And I think that's very clever. But once we're in Novigrad, like, you know, how can we bring the player just to get that sense of perspective every now and then? Are there things that we can do? Have you seen games do this well?
Yeah, I imagine. I mean, in Novigrad, you had like this huge team make a place. I mean, if you look at Novigrad, and this is a small parenthesis, but it's worth, you know, opening up and then closing. You know, if you look at Novigrad, it actually would be able to house the population that it claims to have, at least up to 60 or 70%. Which is impressive. I mean, you do have enough buildings to actually put those people in. And that's very cool, but it's also incredibly expensive. I would say that, you know, achieving something like that in an open world is, relatively speaking, difficult. You know, even though you can obstruct stuff, you can use symbols, you can curve your roads and hide, you know, the shortness of distance and all those things. But you can do it on more curated spaces way more effectively. And I think that one of my favorite examples would have to be Dishonored. And in Dishonored, you are playing in this vast place, and you do have the feeling that you're playing in a you know, London-level metropolis, and yet you only visit a few levels. And the thing is that you're given views, you're given maps, and most importantly, you have this, like, you know, boat trip from place A to place B every time you go to a new level, which has, you know, those low poly things around you, and it connects all those, you know, disparate locations, all those points in implied space into a cohesive whole. And that really works. It gives you the idea that, look, this is a real city. You don't get to visit everything, But it feels right.
But
it's really joining something. Everything up together in a kind of continuous way.
Exactly.
I kind of want to... Sorry, I know you have a question to talk about. I just wanted to name check the Spider-Man games, the recent Spider-Man games, actually. Because obviously they do build a significant chunk of city. But I was really struck by how... Because they made a traversal system that was so fun to do, do actually travel from every point to every point, and you start to see the city as an interconnected set of spaces. Whereas if I was fast traveling every time, it would be like my impression of New York in real life, which is I got on the subway and I saw a bit here, and I got on the subway and I saw a bit there, and it doesn't join up at all to me. So actually, I feel that New York in the Spider-Man game is more of a real place than New York in reality, for me personally, because I've actually like walked the streets.
I mean, I have attempted walking in New York is very difficult, but, and it takes a long time to do so. But still, yeah, you're very right. I mean, there are open world games that are really impressive in that regard, and I imagine that they must have been incredibly expensive to create. You know, usually, I mean, at least from my experience, you know, usually working on stuff that's like AAA or indie and this sort of scale, you know, you always tend to think of ways to cut down on costs and make things plausible and actually achievable. But yeah, I mean, a game like this is excellent. And it's also, I mean, it has to be, because the main thing you're doing is actually traversing, you know, by hanging and doing things. So
absolutely.
It has to be there.
I think we're circling around actually a quite interesting topic here, which is that there is a difference in how you would do this if you were building a relatively open world structure than if you are doing something that is likely to be more linear. And it is often the case that the former is way more expensive. So it sucks all the air out of the room, right? So we tend to think about like, oh yeah, these big cities that are made by Rockstar or for a Spider-Man game or for a CD Projekt Red game, and they're extraordinary because so much investment has been poured into making those things real, right? But this seems sort of obvious, I suppose, in retrospect. But of course, if you're making something like that, you need to give the player something interesting to do, a reason to be exploring through the space. And very often, the answer is combat, right? So like in the Yakuza series, for example, you know, they really make dense a small district, but it's because there's always something kind of interesting to do through it. Whereas a title like Dishonored, like you're saying, you only need to hint. You have to put a painting of your old level in the background to make it feel like it's actually quite big, quite large.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the idea is that you have to know what, and like when we were speaking generally about citizen games, right? You have to be very, very precise about what game you're working on. So what needs to be done? I mean, in a racing game, good, you need the whole city. You need to have all the roads.
True.
You also, have to change the geometry of the roads. I mean, if you look at the roads of racing cities, they don't resemble actual roads. They resemble roads that you find in a racetrack, right? Because you do need the physics there. Good. So the same thing is that, do I want to make an open world game? Apparently, if you're someone who takes executive decisions, yes, you do. There's no actual, you know, there's not always an actual reason to do so. But people do that constantly. And, you know, it can get dull, or it can get filled with combat, which, I don't know, I mean, I find it a huge shame in games like Assassin's Creed, Origins, it was in Egypt, in Ptolemaic Egypt, which is this wonderful stunning place, and what you do is you just beat guys up. It's like, and then I mean, you play this educational version of the game, which has no gameplay in it, and you just walk around and look at things, and it's fascinating, and it's wonderful, and the things they've done are, you know, jaw-dropping, and it's all like completely cheapened by having you know, just murder people every two steps of the way, which is the same, but okay, not much you can do there. The thing is that, you know, open worlds have to be dull because, you know, actually traversing long distances without things happening is dull. And it's even worse in games. I mean, think about it. I mean, if you take a walk, a 15-minute walk, say to the post office, say to pick up a book, it's fine. It's like a nice, you know, relaxing walk. You don't feel bored. You look around you. You look at people. You, I don't know, you look at the shops, whatever. A 15-minute walk feels fine in reality. A 15-minute walk within a game world is mind-numbingly dull. It's excruciatingly dull. So you cannot really do that. You have to constantly have things for the players to do. Now, there's a very interesting game that a friend of mine is working. I don't think it will ever get funding because it's far too I don't know. Have you seen a movie by Yiannopoulos, who is one of the he's the best known Greek director? He had those very slow, but beautifully shot movies. And my friend wanted to make a game like that. And the whole idea is that you walk through those wonderful, very well framed sequences. And as you walk, you know, just by holding the left thumbstick, you're just having conversations with another person, usually, you know, about politics or philosophy and something like that. And you use the triggers to cycle through your options. And this is, that was wonderful. It lets you take in, you know, your surroundings. It lets you actually, you know, have interesting conversations. But it's also something that nobody ever would think of funding, which is a shame.
Yeah, in Heaven's Vault, in Inkle's Heaven, Inkle game Heaven's Vault, we had these sailing sequences between moons, and our idea for that was exactly that you're walking through this, you're sailing through this beautiful vista, but you're doing conversation at the same time, and it's an opportunity to just sit and talk to each other. And some people find it very relaxing, but most people are like, where is the skip button? There has to be a skip button here. And it's interesting because when we built that, what we were thinking about was actually specifically L.A. Noire, which I always think is a really interesting example of this, because they built this period, 1930s.
Fascinating.
L.A. But there's literally nothing to do in it because they didn't litter it with combat and merchants and like
because they wanted it to be real.
They wanted it to be real. Yeah. So you just drive through it for no reason at all apart from it's there. And I kind of wanted to love it. I felt on an artistic level I ought to love this. But by the third time I did it, I was like, I can't. I just can't. Yeah. It's terrible.
You need something to do. I mean, the truth is, like, when you're playing games, you're in a certain mode, right? There's like a way that you kind of structure this. It's funny because, like, as game developers, I feel like the prototype city we have in our minds is this, like, this type of city that, like, maybe existed in a very specific area for a very specific time, but it's this, like, medieval walled city, right? So we, of course, so many of our cultures have had walled cities. It actually brings to mind something like Kare in Sorcery 2, John, probably this is far in your past, I suppose, but you really anticipate the arrival into that city. You go around it. It surprises you in the ways in which you can kind of go deep into it. But you're able to kind of explore every nook and cranny because it's a text heavy game and you can go deeper into something that otherwise would have taken a big cost, right? So I mean, it does matter what type of game you're making, I suppose. Or maybe, I mean, how did you deal with that?
Well, I mean, in Sorcery leans on the fact that you can have a new verb in every single encounter, right? So one of our goals for that was a city that you could explore, and then every corner of the city you go, okay, what's going to happen here, and how is the player going to get themselves into trouble this time? But it's interesting to think about it in terms of the entrance to the city. I don't know if you've played it, Konstantinos, but...
Yes, I've started to play it up to the third game, actually.
Right.
Which is good.
But they're kind of... We definitely lean into that. There's a gate. There's a locked door. How are you going to approach this? And I think one of the things that we're... Because we don't have graphics in that game. What we're trying to sell the whole time is this place is unreasonable and miserable and out to get you. And so it's just constantly people saying, would you like to come in? Well, you can't. this is a door that will not open. And that's what we're selling the whole time.
Well, it implies content, right? Like, this is what you've been talking about, Konstantinos. Is like, how can you use that? Yeah, how can you use that tool of suggestion? Which, for some reason, we just don't. We sort of feel like, well, the player has to have everything or nothing, and we don't seem to use the tools that other media make use of.
I think that we should try and use them more, to be honest. And, you know, you can use everything from, you know, very simple symbolism. And again, my go-to example for this would have to be, you remember the original Deus Ex, and at some point you encounter three or four homeless people in this cyberpunk version of New York. And that's it. That's all the homeless people you see. Yet they are more than enough to tell you that this is a place where homeless people exist, that there are probably lots of them. You can use symbols. You can obstruct stuff. You can suggest stuff, especially if you're working with text. And in reality, I mean, text and interactive text also is quite magical. I mean, it's relatively cheap to produce, okay, relatively, but still it's cheaper than, you know, creating assets. And it can do amazing stuff. And you can just change an adjective or an adverb and add an extra word to description, and suddenly things change drastically. And also you have this amazing opportunity to showcase the things that you want. Because, I mean, if I want you to notice a spire in a sprawling 3D open world city, I really have to go to town. Yeah. I have to, you know, animate it and have things pointing at it and whatever. But then, you know, if I have a paragraph describing the thing and tell you that the Black Spire stands out, well, the Black Spire stands out. That's it.
Yeah.
And this is a fantastic tool that, you know, sometimes you can combine those things. I mean, my go-to city would have to be New Orleans from the original Gabriel Knight game.
Mm. And I love how deeply you've played adventure games. I mean, you have so many good references in here.
Yeah. I know.
Gabriel Knight, Thimbleweed Park, these are solids, yeah.
I know. It's overkill. But still, I mean, I love those games. And in reality, I mean, if you think about what this city consists of, it's nothing. It's like it's a couple maps, like two-dimensional low-resolution bitmaps and something like 30 static screens. That's it. And yet you feel that this is a huge, complex place. One of the reasons you achieve that, one of the ways to achieve this is with this density of information. Like you mentioned before in Yakuza, there's a lot of things packed in a small place. And this tends to suggest scale, which is another technique to use. I mean, Dishonored does that too. There's a lot of things in a small space, and you know that the complexity and the variety sort of suggests urban scale. You know that you won't find too many people in the village.
Yeah, one other thing that I think is really interesting, thinking about the kind of old adventure game style of doing this, do you remember the Discworld game?
Oh, so
you,
yes.
Of course,
a bulk of it, possibly all of it, was in Ankh-Morpork, the kind of capital city. And one thing that game did was it had one of those 2D top-down overview maps, which is common to a lot of these point-and-click of the period. And it would start with sort of two or three locations you could go to. I mean, there was the university, and there was probably a pub, and I can't remember what else. But then over the course of the game, it would add more locations to the kind of the menu of places you could go. You'd discover a place that might be useful, and then it was added to your map. And I think there's something in that starting simple and then and teaching the player, oh, here is the boundary of what we've built, and then opening that boundary up. And then saying, okay, that's what we built. And then opening it up again. And then opening it up again. And that kind of constantly zooming out to create a bigger and bigger world or a denser and denser city. I think that's really effective. I mean, it's completely different than what we did in something like Sorcery, where you're just sort of flood-filling the map as you walk across it. It's much more kind of, it's built for a game where you ping backwards and forwards. But I love the way that by the end of that game, you're looking at the map going, oh yeah, I know every corner of this place. I've been to all these places. You have that kind of, the journey of exploring the city and learning it is literally kind of the journey of the game, or at least the chunk of it.
And
there.
It's a nice feeling.
Really,
I mean,
effective.
You know, this feeling of mastery of urban space, which is something we also do in reality. I mean, you know this city.
Very real.
Right? I mean, you know your hometown. You know your the place you visit a lot. So this is something that translates into, you know, how you can traverse it, like, you know, whether you're surprised by things or what type of things you're surprised. Again, this is something that I wanted to cover a bit more in depth in the article Run Out of Space, apparently. It's like, you know, the difference between casting the player as a foreigner, which is relatively easier. I mean, you know nothing, your avatar knows nothing, good. And casting them as someone who has been living there their whole time, while simultaneously, you know, telling them about this place without, you know, seemingly telling
forcing
them anything. You wouldn't, right? I mean, you wouldn't tell, you know, someone living in Berlin what Berlin is like. They should know that. So, you know, the way to suggest all those things is also an interesting thing. Manuals could work here wonderfully, by the way.
Ah, yes.
Because let's keep it old school.
No, very old school. This is actually what I wanted to say, is that, like, these old school references, I think, are really quite relevant. So, bizarrely, you mentioned New Orleans and Gabriel Knight. New Orleans, for some reason, is, like, the city that adventure games keep coming back to over and over and over again. Like, adventure games seem to me to be particularly strong at being able to do this because I think of what you said. I think because you can just have a couple different characters that represent things, and you get this notion that you're just looking at one city alleyway, it could be almost anywhere. Like, Norco was one of my favorite games of the last few years, and they also do New Orleans, and they also do it incredibly well. You have this anticipation, you come into it, this entire structure. So it does strike me that what you just described, talking about manuals, all these different things, could work not just for urban areas. I mean, clearly it works really well for urban areas, but almost any sort of core area in a game, right? I mean, maybe you perhaps don't have as much in a village, but there are some games, for example, that take place exclusively in, like, a building, like in a haunted house, or Control does this, right? It's like in one very large, very personality-filled building, right? So is that true? Is it the case that these principles are relevant really for any video game area, or what do you think?
I would say yes. I don't know, John. What would you say? I would say
well,
yes,
I mean, you're the guest, frankly. So I think.
Okay, fair enough. But no, I do think that, you know, being careful in how you construct spaces, and having, you know, having developed not necessarily the lore. I mean, the, don't really care too much about the lore. I mean, you can be incredibly detailed or not. Doesn't really matter that much. But, you know, having a strong idea of what it is you want to achieve and knowing how to achieve it. For example, in Control, you understand, you know, you understand how concrete works in brutalism. You understand how it reflects things. You understand how it looks. You understand why it looks the way it does. You understand that, you know, in order to have this type of concrete, you need someone who can be very good with, I don't know what the word is in English. It's the thing that you know, put those planks so that, you know, the concrete will stay in place while drying.
I also don't know what that word is. Yeah.
Yeah, I know it in Greek. Okay, I learned it a couple years ago. I had to do that, so that's how you learn those things. But yeah, I think you have to understand, and you also, and this is something that really saddens me. I mean, we tend getting those incredibly expensive games, and I understand why they're expensive, because I mean, you do have all those people like putting in hundreds of hours and thousands of hours, and you have specialists and consultants and marketing people and all those things. And yet we've moved completely away from the physical artifact of the game, which is something that is not obsolete, if you ask me. I mean, I really enjoy buying something in a box that comes with a manual that tells me something, with a feely, with something like that. I don't enjoy it if it's, you know, a collector's version that costs 10 times the, you know, the game's price, which, okay, it's not for me, obviously, but, you know, taking the time, and I've seen this in actual indie games, you know, you have like this small box with some interesting things put in there for you to enhance your appreciation of the game. It makes it feel less throwaway. It makes you sort of want to focus in on it more. And that's a very interesting thing, because, I mean, nowadays I think I have something like 2,500 games in my Steam catalog.
Like, amazing.
Seriously, I mean, you know, I get them for everything from IGF to you know, bundles to anything, and you know, most of those games I've never even touched, which is a shame. I mean, I imagine that most of them have very, very interesting things happening in them and some fantastic ideas, and yet they're treated as something that's, you know, incredibly cheap, and you know, if you spend a couple hours with it, that's it, you're fine.
I mean, well, this artifact, the sense of the artifact and what you can do with it. The reason I asked you about whether this can work in places beyond just urban areas is the manual, and particularly the map, like the way that John was talking about. This is such a common element for not adventure games as a genre, but games in which you are adventuring, in which you are exploring a new space. And it brings to mind the relatively recent Zelda-style game, Tunic. And I don't know if you've played it, but yes. Tunic has, as a central mechanic, that you arrive in an area, it's not urban, but you arrive in an area, you don't know what it is, and you have a manual that you cannot read. You cannot read the manual. You start to uncover it and learn how to, a digital manual, right? Like, it's a game mechanic, and you discover it as you go through the game, what these different places are, only after you visit them. Basically, after you discover a district and explore it from there. I mean, there's something that really understands the same value I think you're talking about.
And if you think about Tunic, it does evoke this feeling that games used to evoke back when I was young, and this does not have to do with necessarily with the change of type of games you're making. It has to do with you know, difference in age. So it's sort of, there are some games that manage to you know, awaken in you, you know, this feeling of discovery and joy and bewilderment, and you know, this thing that you have as a kid that you don't quite understand what's going on. And by not quite understanding, you're not certain as to what to expect, and everything can surprise you or upset you or really, you know, give you a completely different perspective. And Tunic did that. It sort of treated you as if you were a child in a world that you cannot fully understand, and you will only gradually get to understand, and you will, you know, earn insight and understand what you did before and where you were and why you were. And this is a fantastic feeling. Again, not the only feeling we need to evoke, but absolutely a very, very fascinating one.
I feel this is a really interesting game design problem, though, right down at the core of it, that for us to have that experience of going into a space and starting to understand it, there has to be something to understand, and there has to be basically something for the player to do that allows them to activate and act on
to progress into it.
Because when I think about the underwhelming cities that I've experienced in games, That's a really harsh way to judge them, but generally speaking, the problem is you arrive at some kind of large environment and you enter it, and the game is fundamentally the same inside the city as it is outside the city. I still run around the streets, I see a lot more NPCs, but I can't talk to them. You know, I can, there might be a shop or two, there might be a kind of a pickup, there might be a quest marker, a dude with an arrow over his head, but I don't get the sense of, oh, now I'm in a city, I have a different quality of experience, or even that my character behaves in a different way. I'm particularly thinking of there were sort of cities and settlements in Horizon Zero Dawn, which I really enjoyed as a game, but inside and outside of a city, it never felt distinct to me, when actually this is a game about a terrifying wilderness and pockets of kind of survival within that. And I'm not sure how you solve that game design problem, or in that specific game, or in general, but I think just something that gives us that if we're going to try and make these cities feel like real places, we probably need to solve that on quite a fundamental level and say, okay, now I'm in a city, what does a player do that's fundamentally different here and I can only do here to bring that to life? Which is, you know, earlier we said that we rely too much on combat, and I think generally speaking in games that's what we do when we don't know what else to do, right? If we don't know what to do, we put a fight in.
It's an easy solution, but also, but I mean, you know, if you think about what cities have been known for and why people flock to them, then, you know, you can get your answers depending on the genre. For example, I mean, I'm thinking, why did, say, Athens grow in the 40s and the 50s? Because people came here to hide. And where do you hide? You hide in the anonymity of the city. And this is something that, for example, you know, that at least the first few Assassin's Creed games did very well. You had this crowd mechanic that you would never be able to find in the countryside. So you have this very specific city-like mechanic that allows you to blend in, to become invisible. And this is something
a perfect metaphor.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that will work, provided that the game allows for that. Or, you know, you could have, you know, you have this abundance of options. And the abundance of options sort of translates into, you know, you wouldn't be able to find a game store in a small town in Europe in the 80s or 90s, but you would certainly find like 10 of them in any metropolis. And this difference in options sort of should allow you to explore, you know, different possibilities within the game space, or, you know, you have more people to ask, or what was the game, it's called Watchdog Legions and Watchdog Teams before that, which was it played with urban systems. I mean, it gave you this hacking interface that allowed you to you know, regulate traffic and change things depending on what you wanted to do. And this was an interesting thing. That's a very city only example. And the final thing I have to say on that is that has to do with Witcher 3, and I found that incredibly impressive, the fact that they took the time to look into this. And I mean, yes, there were people in the middle of the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance were obviously very, very poor in cities too, but being poor in a city was like a huge improvement over being poor in the countryside. And The Witcher 3 is one of the few games that acknowledges that, and suddenly you realize that, you know, the poor people here might, you know, not be having a great time, but compared to what's happening outside the city walls, they're living in paradise. And you have this juxtaposition of what happens within and without the walls, and that really, you know, helps you feel as if you're in a different place. Yeah. And also, it's very handy.
Just makes me think that there's a whole, I don't know, there's a whole avenue of human activity that I don't know that games have really explored, which is trading, right? In if you think back in kind of history, people didn't travel very much, except traders and merchants did, and they would go from one city to another, taking the thing that was abundant here and taking it to the place there where it was scarce, and making a profit that way, and learning what every city had to offer and what it needed was kind of key to becoming successful at that. And there's surprisingly few games about that, even though it's sort of an obvious thing to be doing, really.
It's amazing that you just redesigned 80 Days for yourself, John. That is precisely your core mechanic.
Come on, we just threw the 80 Days, the training on top, just to provide a bit of entertainment.
The fact that we've gotten this far in this conversation without talking about 80 Days as a way of entering cities.
I want to say that, you know, 80 Days was a wonderful not abstraction, but more of a condensing of the idea. A few vignettes that were really telling of where you are. And that was very effective. And I mean, obviously, you erased anything that was not a city, just, you know, moved from point to point, so that the globe is just there to give you context. But, you know, the places felt genuinely different and interesting. And you didn't need, you know, anything. You needed, you know, text.
It's so much that thing you were talking about, focus, that when you can say you arrive in a city of 3 million people and there's one woman that you're going to talk to, like, the just the joy of that is fantastic, because you can get right down to the interesting bit within two sentences. Whereas if you build the world, how are you ever going to find this woman? You're never going to find this woman.
And direct the attention of the player. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's marvelous.
So this was a discussion we're having, you know, during the pre-production of The Sinking City. And there was this idea, because, I mean, if you read The Shadow Over Innsmouth, at some point Lovecraft tries to tell you that this is a really weird place, this is a really cut-off place, and they didn't have a single bank. Which is fantastic, right? I mean, it tells you something. And then you say, okay, we won't have a single bank in the game. Right, nobody will notice, ever. As in, they won't. Because there's no reason to.
And why would you point out, yeah.
I mean, this is the power of text is, I mean, I don't know why it's being often ignored. I mean, obviously, yeah, not by Engel, but, you know, generally speaking, it's treated as if it's something easy and just there to fill in the gaps. Whereas, you know, we've had several thousands of years of literature, you know, evoking everything from feelings and you know, revolutions and everything, based entirely on the power of text. And it's there, and it won't ever go away. And we should learn to leverage it, not necessarily in text-only games. But, you know, you can use it. A dialogue can tell you a lot about a city. And have you played Subsurface Circular by Mike Bivel?
No.
And this is very interesting. It's a detective game. Effectively, you're playing a robot within. You're sitting in a wagon in the metro, and you're just going around the city, and you're talking to other robots, trying to find out something. And the whole city is abstracted into the subway map. That's it. And everything you learn about it is through conversation, and it really builds it up in your mind. I mean, yeah, the graphics are cool, they're very simple, but you're only in the tube and you see nothing. It works. I mean, you really don't have to render everything. You can tell people things, you can use, you know, things like images and maps and stuff that has been painted in-world to tell them stuff, to let them flesh out things. I mean, even in Disco Elysium, you never really show Revachol.
Yeah,
I mean, you just have this wonderful background in the menu, that's it.
Well, there's been a real resurgence recently in games leaning on the text to do that. So you have Citizen Sleeper, and you have Disco Elysium, and you have Esoteric Ebb, and you have Blake Manor. And these are all games which, you know, they have a visual component. Mm-hmm. It's strong. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. They've thought about it. But sometimes I wonder whether the visual component is mostly there so that they have good screenshots to sell the game, but actually the majority of the game is happening in the text window on the side. True. Like, is that a more honest way of describing these games? I'm really not sure. I don't mean to be controversial, but I think that is an avenue in which people are rediscovering the power of text in a way that, you know, is palatable to the market and kind of works out okay, and people feel like it's a decent compromise. And it's much easier to imagine, you know, expanding that model to cover kind of these wider, more subtle experiences of cities that we've been talking about than it is to imagine taking Horizon Zero Dawn or whatever and digging down into their cities to make them really rich and alive, because just the sheer cost of doing any detail work there is so extraordinary.
I think that the detail is also an interesting discussion. I mean, you could go with something really lo-fi. You could go with, you know, untextured blocks and 3D that's reminiscent of what we had during the 90s or the 80s, like the Freescape game, something like that. That, you know, again, if the thing is cohesive, I mean, and now we can do it like very easily and very cheaply, you can have this vast world that's very abstracted, and you have the equally abstracted, you know, verbs to interact with it. And it could be huge and simple without being incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes, you know, if you take the same seven blocks, I mean, if I take seven white cubes and arrange them in different ways and paint a road between them, I can come up with like seven different types of road that will tell you
very different things.
Seven different types of places. So
I always remember when I went to see the remastered version of Blade Runner, they put it, mm-hmm. you know, the film, obviously, they put it into 4K, and it works less well in 4K because you can see that it's the same street set
every single
time they go outside, because you can see the background. Whereas when you watch it on a kind of crackly old film version, there's enough fog and smoke that it could be that the city feels enormous. And like just that lack of detail actually is both aesthetically more pleasing and more effective.
I feel we're circling around basically this. I feel the conclusion we have been touching on is that focus really makes a difference in these things. Mm-hmm. Like that you can often do a lot more with a localized, dense space that then implies a lot more, or that gives you certain things to do. And while a lot of our attention ends up getting drawn to the bigger open world attempts at this, I wonder whether that's even the most productive line of reasoning for this, just simply because they will always be characterized by a challenge of economy, of like they've built a bunch of different verbs, and those verbs need to be applicable throughout because they don't know what the player is going to do in different areas. And so the problem you identify, John, I just feel it's the problem that Oblivion has. It's the problem that Skyrim has. It's just everywhere. It sort of feels like, oh, this is just a big town. That's how those places can sometimes feel. And I think it's much more interesting to think like, the games that have chosen to say, I'm all about this city. Like, this is the thing I'm doing. Astrologaster is all about Elizabethan London, right? Like, and you don't see it. You just have conversations, right? Or a game that uses text in the way that we've just discussed. Or say Disco, which is like not just, it implies a city, implies a culture, but it's really about like a very focused neighborhood, right? That I feel like that density is really strong. We had Star Colburn on, who was talking about exactly this. Like in a slightly lower poly way, you might be able to produce a tremendous amount of density that can help you tell stories kind of on your own. So that I think feels like a path to consider for other game makers looking at games like this. Yeah.
There are also different solutions. I mean, I do agree that the focus should be there, that the details should be there, that we should always know what, you know, we should have a very strong idea in our mind as to what it is we want the place to feel like, whether it's a city or not. But you know, there are also tools that are, you know, unique to games. I mean, like procedural generation can be very impressive. I mean, if you think, I don't know, there's this this crime game, it's called Shadows of Doubt, I think.
Yeah, so
that's Starks. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. That's so, I mean, this is a wonderful thing. And, you know, even though procedurality often gets, you know, dull or pointless, I mean, you can have the thousand different things which are essentially, you know, meaningless, so you don't really care about them. But still, this has been woven into the fabric of the game and really helps. And that is very interesting. Or, I mean, you could have this huge map and you just click on places and you have a procedurally generated little neighborhood just for you to go there and, I don't know, do your noir detective-y dialogue with a person. And it's just there to suggest that this is a vast place. And sometimes, you know, this is something you need to do without resorting to open worlds. I don't really, I enjoy very few open worlds, to be honest, with the exception of Zelda. Mm. Zelda did it very, very interestingly because it's packed with tiny things. And that works.
Fantastic. Well, I think this has been a really interesting conversation. I don't think it's something that I'd ever really thought about in much detail before. So it's fantastic to have you on to really drill down into it. So thank you very much, Konstantinos. Listeners, please join us next week when we will open the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope to another page and bring on another fantastic game writer. But for now, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you.